Think for a second, right, about the physical security of a modern enterprise data center. Like, if you really want to protect your company's most sensitive data, you're relying on biometric scanners, armed guards.
Man traps, heavy steel cages, the works.
Exactly. It's a literal physical fortress.
Yeah.
But what if you suddenly realized that the walls of the microscopic chips powering those servers are practically made of glass?
Yeah, that is not a comforting thought.
It really isn't, because if an attacker knows exactly how to manipulate the physics of the silicon, I mean, they don't need to breach the physical building. They can sit half a world away and just peer right through the walls of your most secure applications.
It's a terrifying realization, and it really fundamentally shatters that illusion of impenetrable digital infrastructure that we all kind of rely on
Right.
because we spend so much time worrying about, software firewalls and encryption algorithms. But we rarely stop to consider that the foundational layer, the actual physical processor itself, might be inherently leaky.
Which is exactly what we're looking at today on this deep dive. We are unpacking the collapse of serverless edge isolation.
A massive topic.
Huge. Specifically, we're diving into a groundbreaking cybersecurity exploit from an August 2026 technical autopsy by Tikingame. It's called the Remote Timer as a Service, or RTS Spectre attack.
Yeah, the RTS exploit. It's wild.
It's completely wild. Our mission today is to explore how an academic research team, basically acting as the ultimate red team, managed to steal highly confidential data out of seemingly secure cloud boundaries. And they did it at a rate of 12 bits per second with near-perfect accuracy.
Which doesn't sound like a lot, but we'll get into why that's actually devastating.
Right. And perhaps most importantly, we need to understand how Cloudflare, one of the main architectural pillars of the modern web, had to fundamentally redesign the plumbing of the internet with this three-layer hybrid defense just to stop it from being weaponized.
And really, the underlying catalyst for this entire crisis is a foundational collision. It's this collision between the internet's absolute obsession with speed, our insatiable demand for sub-millisecond response times, and the immutable physical limitations of computer processors.
Physics always wins in the end.
Exactly. We've been pushing silicon to its absolute limits, and the RTS attack is essentially what happens when the physics push back.
Well, let's start with that demand for speed, because to understand why this vulnerability even exists, we have to look at the environment it targets. I mean, why did cloud providers push the physical limits of the silicon in the first place? Like, if I want to host a secure application, why not just put it in a highly secure, digital lockbox?
Well, you can. And for a really long time, that's exactly what the industry did. So let's look at traditional public cloud computing, right? Services like Amazon EC2 or AWS Lambda.
Okay.
Historically, the gold standard for security in those environments has been the hardware micro virtual machine or micro VM. AWS uses one called Firecracker, for example.
And these micro VMs enforce security at the hypervisor level, right?
Correct.
So the hypervisor is basically the software that sits directly on the bare metal hardware, and it chops that hardware up into separate virtualized computers.
Yeah, and it does this with absolutely ruthless physical segregation. It dedicates distinct physically mapped page tables in the memory. It isolates virtual registers in the CPU for every single tenant.
So if you rent a micro VM, you're basically getting your own highly segregated digital bunker.
Exactly. The operating system kernel guarantees that your memory space is mathematically isolated from the tenant on the server right next to you.
I mean, it sounds perfect. So why did anyone ever move away from that?
Initialization overhead. Building that digital bunker takes time.
Right, the setup.
Yeah, when a user requests your application, the cloud provider has to allocate the memory, boot the virtualized operating system, load your runtime environment, and then finally execute your code.
And in the cloud industry, that delay is known as a cold start.
Exactly. And for a micro VM, a cold start typically takes anywhere from, 50 to 300 milliseconds.
Now, to a human being, 300 milliseconds is roughly the blink of an eye. It really doesn't sound like a crisis.
In isolation, it isn't a crisis at all. But in the context of edge computing, 300 milliseconds is an eternity.
Because edge computing is all about instant routing.
Right. It's designed to route traffic and execute code instantly, geographically close to the user. So if you're building a modern, highly interactive web application, you might have dozens of these edge functions firing off for a single page load.
Like authenticating the user, checking inventory, personalizing the UI, all of that.
Yeah, all happening at once. So if you add a 300 millisecond cold start penalty to every single one of those instantaneous routing decisions, the modern web would just grind to a halt. It would feel like you're browsing on a dial-up connection from 1998.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's unacceptable today. So 300 milliseconds is a total deal-breaker for companies like Cloudflare, whose entire brand is built on making the internet ridiculously fast.
Completely. They couldn't use those heavyweight virtual machines. They had to find a completely different architecture.
And they did, right. Cloudflare and a few others just abandoned traditional micro VMs entirely for their edge networks.
They did. Instead, they adopted an architecture based on Google's V8 engine isolates.
Wait, V8 is the same engine that runs JavaScript inside the Google Chrome browser, isn't it?
The very same. But deploying it on a global server network completely changes the security model.
Let's try to visualize the difference between these two approaches for a second. So if traditional micro VMs are like renting separate, highly secure, concrete bunkers for every single customer, you are incredibly safe. Nobody can see your data.
But unlocking that heavy steel door, turning on the lights, walking inside, it takes a long time.
Right. That's your 300 millisecond cold start.
Yeah. And Cloudflare just decided the concrete bunkers were too slow.
So instead of bunkers, the V8 isolate model is more like taking thousands of complete strangers, all these different customer applications, and putting them into a single, massive, shared, open plan office building.
I love that analogy, yes.
So this open plan office represents one giant monolithic Linux operating system process running on the server. Everyone is just sitting at desks right next to each other.
And because there are no heavy steel doors to unlock anymore, the cold start time basically vanishes.
Right. But now you have a massive security problem.
Yeah.
You have competitors and potentially malicious actors sitting at adjacent desks.
Exactly.
So to keep things secure, you rely entirely on an incredibly strict HR policy.
Right.
And this policy is the software sandbox. It basically dictates that no one is allowed to stand up, walk over, and peek at their neighbor's desk.
And to be fair, the performance gains of this open plan office model are just staggering. Like we mentioned, latency drops from 300 milliseconds down to under 5 milliseconds.
That's a massive difference.
It is. And the memory footprint shrinks dramatically, too. A traditional micro VM requires a base overhead of about 128 megabytes of RAM just to boot up. A V8 isolate operates with a tiny footprint of around 3 megabytes.
Oh, wow. So you can pack tens of thousands of these isolates onto a single physical server.
Exactly. It's a masterpiece of efficiency.
But the entire model hinges on absolute trust in that HR policy. The software sandbox has to be flawless. Because if it fails, you are sharing a room with thousands of people who might be actively trying to steal your data.
Which brings us to a really uncomfortable reality for anyone listening to this deep dive. When you load a modern web app or, you know, check out on an e-commerce site or log into a portal for work, you are almost certainly passing through one of these sub-millisecond edge workers.
They sit right between you and the main servers, handling your authentication tokens and your session data.
Yeah, and you are trusting that the invisible software walls in that shared open plan office cannot be breached.
But the autopsy of the RTI exploit proves that the HR policy isn't enough when an attacker figures out how to exploit the underlying physics of the building itself.
Exactly.
So let's move into how this attack actually works. We've got untrusted scripts sharing the same physical silicon. If the software sandbox strictly prevents them from reading each other's memory, how does data actually leak?
Well, the leak happens because of a microarchitectural flaw in the hardware itself. The root cause is a vulnerability known as Spectre Variant 2, or branch target injection.
Okay, Spectre. We've heard that name before.
Right. And it's critical to understand that this is not a software bug. You can't just patch the operating system or rewrite the HR policy to fix it. It is a fundamental vulnerability in the physical design of modern CPUs, specifically in a feature called speculative execution.
Let's break that down, because speculative execution sounds like the CPU is just guessing what it's supposed to do.
In a way, it actually is. Modern processors are incredibly fast, much faster than the main memory they rely on.
Right.
So if a CPU has to wait for data to be fetched from the main RAM before it can decide what instruction to execute next, it just ends up sitting idle for hundreds of clock cycles.
Just wasting time.
Exactly. So to prevent this, engineers developed pipelining and indirect branch predictors.
So a branch predictor is essentially the CPU trying to look ahead in the code to see what's coming next.
Yes. When the CPU encounters a conditional branch in the code, like an if-in statement, it doesn't wait to find out which path is the correct one. Based on past behavior, it predicts which path is most likely, and it starts speculatively executing those instructions ahead of time.
Oh, I see.
It pulls the necessary data into its fast local cache memory, and if its prediction is correct, it saves a massive amount of time.
But what if it predicts wrong?
Well, if it guesses wrong, a few fractions of a microsecond later, the CPU realizes its mistake. It immediately throws away all the speculative work, flushes the pipeline, and goes down the correct path.
So, from the perspective of the software, the incorrect path was never executed. The sandbox remains perfectly intact.
Correct. That's how it's supposed to work.
Okay, I want to try an analogy here to make this tangible, but let's build together. Let's say the CPU is a hyperactive, overeager librarian.
Okay, I like it.
And I go to the front desk and I keep handing them request slips for books in the public safe section of the library.
Right, so you're establishing a pattern. You're training the branch predictor. You do this thousands of times. So the librarian gets used to just sprinting down a very specific, completely safe aisle.
Exactly. Then I slip in a malicious request. I give them a slip that actually asks for a highly restricted file from the top secret vault in the back. And that vault represents the memory of another tenant in our open plan office.
Ah, okay.
So because the librarian is so conditioned to run, they don't even stop to read the authorization stamp on the slip. They just sprint toward the
All
vault.
right, they speculatively execute your request. They run into the vault and they actually grab the restricted file.
But then the security guard catches them. And the security guard represents the software sandbox checking the permissions. The guard yells, "Hey, you don't have clearance for that."
At which point, the librarian panics, drops the top secret file, and runs out of the vault totally empty-handed. They come back to the front desk and tell you, "Sorry, I can't fulfill that request."
Right, so the security system worked. The software sandbox successfully blocked the illegal RID. I, as the attacker, was not handed the data.
And this is where the microarchitectural flaw really comes in. The librarian didn't hand you the file, but in their rush, they left muddy footprints on the exact folder you were curious about. They disturbed the dust in the vault.
Precisely. And those muddy footprints are the transient residue left behind in the CPU's cache memory.
Exactly. Even though the CPU discarded the speculative execution, the physical act of moving that data from the slow main memory into the fast CPU cache leaves a measurable trace. The cache state has been altered.
So if I'm the attacker, I don't need the librarian to hand the file at all. I just need a way to look at the footprints and figure out which file they touched.
That is the absolute essence of a side channel attack. You aren't breaking the lock on the front door, you're just listening to the tumblers click to figure out the combination.
That is wild.
But looking at those microscopic footprints in a CPU cache requires a very specific tool. It requires a stopwatch.
Because you have to measure time to know if a file is in the cache or not.
Exactly. And this brings us to the monumental challenge the attackers faced. To read the footprints, they have to measure the access time of specific memory addresses.
Right.
If the data the attacker wants to probe is already sitting in the CPU cache, meaning it's a hit because the speculative trick pulled it in, it takes the CPU about 4 clock cycles to access it.
Okay, 4 clock cycles.
But if the data is not in the cache amiss and the CPU has to fetch it all the way from the main dynamic random access memory, or DRAM, it takes roughly 200 clock cycles.
4 cycles versus 200 cycles. Okay, in relative terms, one is 50 times slower than the other. But in absolute terms, we are talking about nanoseconds here. A modern CPU does billions of cycles per second.
Yeah, we're talking about distinguishing between a process that takes maybe 2 nanoseconds versus one that takes 60 nanoseconds.
Wow.
It requires an incredibly precise, high-resolution hardware clock. Now, back in 2018, when the original Spectre vulnerabilities were first disclosed to the world, browser vendors and cloud providers panicked.
Naturally.
But they quickly realized the attack had a massive dependency, the stopwatch.
Right, because if the attacker can't measure that tiny 196 cycle difference, they can't see the muddy footprints. The attack just fails.
So the industry took the stopwatches away. They aggressively stripped high-resolution local hardware clocks from all shared environments.
How do they do that?
Well, in JavaScript, for instance, they degraded the accuracy of functions like performance.now. They added artificial jitter, basically random mathematical noise, to the timers so that you could no longer get a clean nanosecond measurement.
And within Cloudflare Workers specifically, access to local hardware timestamp counters was strictly suppressed by the platform architecture itself.
Exactly. The defensive strategy was brilliant in its simplicity. Just blind the attacker by removing their ability to perceive micro time.
And for a while it worked, which is what makes the breakthrough in this 2026 autopsy absolutely staggering. If the cloud providers took all the stopwatches away, how on earth did this research team manage to read the footprints?
This is the core ingenuity of the Remote Timer as a Service, or RTSS, exploit. The academic researchers at the University of Edinburgh, working alongside Cloudflare's internal security teams, proved something that most of the industry thought was physically impossible.
Which was?
They proved that they didn't actually need a local clock running inside the worker isolate at all.
Wait, hold on. If they don't have a clock inside the building, how are they measuring nanoseconds?
They established a remote timing oracle.
A remote oracle, okay.
Yeah. The attackers opened a persistent, full duplex WebSocket stream between their malicious script running on the edge worker and a remote external server that they fully controlled somewhere else on the internet.
A WebSocket stream.
Yeah.
So they just left a network pipe open, constantly streaming data back and forth.
Yes. The malicious worker on the edge would execute the speculative trick training, the branch predictor, tricking the librarian. But instead of trying to time the cache response locally, it immediately bounced a network packet back through the WebSocket to the external server.
And the external server?
The external server, which the attacker owned, did have high-resolution hardware clocks.
Okay, I have to push back on this because physics just don't seem to make sense. You're telling me a network packet travels over miles of fiber optic cable, bounces through random internet routers, deals with massive network latency.
Yep.
And somehow, that messy, noisy journey is used to measure a 60 nanosecond difference happening inside a silicon chip. The network jitter alone should completely drown out a nanosecond signal. It sounds like trying to measure the beat of a butterfly's wings by watching the ripples it makes across the Atlantic Ocean.
Your skepticism is entirely justified, and it's exactly why this research paper is considered a landmark event in cybersecurity.
It just sounds impossible.
The noise-to-signal ratio should have made this impossible, but the researchers use advanced statistical noise cancellation and round-trip time modulation. They weren't just sending one packet. They were flooding the WebSocket with millions of packets, creating a massive statistical sample.
Oh, I see. So they basically brute-forced the statistics.
They did. By analyzing the subtle aggregate variations in the round-trip times of this massive flood of packets, the external server could mathematically filter out the network jitter.
Unbelievable.
They could isolate the sub-microsecond cache access differentials purely by analyzing the returning network traffic. The network itself became the stopwatch.
That is deeply unsettling. They essentially weaponized the latency of the internet to peer inside a sealed microchip.
Pretty much.
Let's look at the actual metrics they achieved with this, because the numbers in the engineering autopsy are what triggered the massive industry response. They achieved a data exfiltration rate of 12 bits per second.
Right.
But the truly wild part is the accuracy. An empirical accuracy rate exceeding 99.2%.
The 99.2% accuracy rate is the linchpin of why this attack is so devastating. When you have lower accuracy in a side-channel attack, say, around 80 or 85%, you are dealing with corrupted data.
Lots of static.
Exactly. To make any sense of it, you have to implement complex error correction codes, or ECC. You have to pull the data multiple times, cross-reference it, and guess the missing bits. All of that computational overhead drastically slows down the effective rate at which you can steal usable information.
But at 99.2%.
At greater than 99.2% raw precision, the need for error correction practically vanishes. The researchers essentially established a clean, transparent, real-time pipeline straight into the adjacent tenant's secure memory.
So they were reading the muddy footprints with perfect clarity over an ocean of network noise.
Exactly.
If you're listening to this and you're used to gigabit broadband connections where you can download a 4K movie in minutes, 12 bits per second, probably sounds laughably slow. Like, it's barely a trickle. Why is the entire cybersecurity industry treating 12 bits per second like a five-alarm fire?
To understand the panic, we have to look at the trajectory of the threat. We have to compare this 2026 event to previous attempts.
Okay, let's look at the history.
In October 2021, a different group of academic researchers managed to demonstrate a primitive cross-isolate Spectre leak in a serverless environment. But they were relying on heavily degraded software thread jitter as their timing source. Their exfiltration rate was only 0.033 bits per second.
0.033 bits per second. So it would take hours just to steal a single character of text.
Exactly. And their accuracy was only around 85.4%, meaning they were heavily bogged down by error correction. So the jump from 0.033 to 12 bits per second represents a staggering 363.6-fold acceleration in data theft throughput.
Over 360 times faster, completely decoupled from local software timers and eliminating the need for error correction.
It's a massive leap.
When you look at the timeline of microarchitectural vulnerabilities, it really paints a grim picture. January 2018 is when Meltdown and Spectre first break, shattering everyone's trust in hardware isolation.
Right.
Then September 2020, the browsers and cloud vendors patched the software by adding jitter to the timers. In 2021, attackers find a slow workaround at 0.033 bits per second. In 2024, the industry rolls out heavier software sandboxes.
And then August 2026.
Exactly. The RTS WebSocket exploit completely bypasses all of it. The through line here seems to be that relying purely on software patches to fix hardware vulnerabilities is a losing battle.
It is an unwinnable war of attrition. If the physical foundation of the house is cracked, applying thicker coats of paint on the walls will only hide the damage for so long.
The cracks always show up again.
Always. The software mitigations, like degrading timers or adding sandboxing layers, are ultimately just workarounds. They add friction, but they don't solve the underlying physics of speculative execution. The attackers continually find new, more sophisticated ways to measure the cache residue, completely outpacing the software defenses.
Okay, so we've established the how. The attackers use an open WebSocket connection as a remote stopwatch to perfectly read the CPU cache footprints of their neighbors at 12 bits per second. Now we need to talk about the what. At 12 bits per second, you aren't downloading gigabytes of proprietary source code or scraping a company's entire SQL database. What are they actually stealing, and why is it so catastrophic for enterprise security?
You're right that bulk data extraction is impossible at this speed, but in modern cloud architecture, you don't need bulk data to completely compromise a system. You just need the keys.
Ah, right.
And edge workers are uniquely positioned to handle the most sensitive keys an enterprise possesses. Modern architectures delegate critical, high-friction tasks to the edge to keep things fast. The most critical of these tasks is authentication and session management.
So we are talking about JSON Web Tokens, JWTs.
Primarily, yes. Edge workers are routinely tasked with the verification of JWTs, API gateway token routing, and session state inspection.
For those who might not be deep into web development, let's clarify what a JWT actually is, because understanding its structure explains why this attack is so lethal.
It's a good idea.
A JSON Web Token is essentially a digital VIP pass. When you log into a secure system, say your company's HR portal, the main server verifies your username and password once. Then, instead of making you log in again on every single page, it hands your browser a JWT. From that point on, your browser just flashes that text-based token at the edge worker.
Right. It's a stateless authentication mechanism. The token itself contains a header, a payload, which holds your user ID and permissions, and crucially, a cryptographic signature. The edge worker inspects the signature to confirm the token hasn't been tampered with. If the signature is valid, the worker lets you through.
Now, here is where the co-location threat becomes a total nightmare. Cloud platforms are multi-tenant. That's the open plan office.
Yes.
An attacker can create a free or incredibly cheap account on a serverless platform, deploy their malicious script, and just wait until their script is randomly assigned to the same physical hardware as a high-value enterprise target.
And because millions of workers are constantly spinning up and down, achieving co-location with a target on the same CPU socket is statistically trivial. Once they are on the same machine, they open their WebSocket and begin passively snooping on the memory at 12 bits per second.
And what are they looking for? Because they aren't looking for random data. They're specifically targeting the memory regions where active JWT tokens and cryptographic headers are being processed.
Precisely. They are targeting the active VIP passes belonging to legitimate users of the adjacent application. If an attacker manages to extract a user's active JWT from the edge worker's memory, they achieve full session hijacking capability.
They don't need the user's password. They don't need to bypass multi-factor authentication. They don't need to intercept an SMS code. They just copy the VIP pass, present it to the server, and the server says, "Welcome back." They become the user.
It completely circumvents the traditional authentication perimeter. And honestly, it gets worse.
How does it get worse?
Edge workers often hold the actual cryptographic secrets, the master private keys used to sign those JWTs in the first place.
Oh, wow.
If the attacker siphons out the master signing key at 12 bits per second, they don't just hijack one session. They can forge their own valid VIP passes for any user, including administrators. The postmortem data makes it clear. Entire corporate authentication perimeters could be systematically harvested in a matter of minutes.
Okay, before anyone listening to this decides to pull the plug on all their cloud deployments, we need to inject a very important caveat that the Ticking Game autopsy emphasizes. This is kind of the silver lining in an otherwise terrifying report.
Very true.
This 2026 exploit was a controlled academic experiment. It was a joint red team operation between the University of Edinburgh and Cloudflare's own internal security division. They found the flaw before it could be exploited in the wild.
That is a vital context. Cloudflare's forensic analysis of their network telemetry over the preceding 3 years confirmed zero evidence of this specific WebSocket timing technique being weaponized by actual threat actors. There was no known customer data exposure.
But as with everything in cybersecurity, the relief is temporary.
Completely temporary. In this field, a proof of concept is basically a countdown timer.
Right.
Once a theoretical attack is proven to be practically feasible in a live production environment, especially with a detailed autopsy outlining the exact methodology weaponization by advanced persistent threats or state-sponsored actors, is inevitable. The blueprint is public.
So if they did nothing?
If Cloudflare had simply published the paper and changed nothing about their infrastructure, active exploitation would have followed within weeks.
Which brings us to the boardroom crisis.
Yeah.
Cloudflare is faced with a fundamental flaw in the silicon that software alone couldn't patch. They have a team of academics successfully stealing data across their network at 12 bits per second. How do they respond?
It was a massive challenge.
Because they are in a massive bind here. If they panic and revert back to the heavy concrete bunkers, the hardware micro VMs, they completely destroy the 5-millisecond latency that defines their entire business model. They lose their competitive advantage.
The engineering response detailed in this autopsy is, frankly, one of the most impressive feats of infrastructure redesign in the past decade. Cloudflare's platform teams realized that the era of relying solely on an inherently vulnerable software sandbox was over.
They had to change the paradigm.
They engineered and rapidly deployed a comprehensive defense-in-depth strategy across their entire global fleet. It's a triple-tier mitigation architecture that shifts from purely software-based isolation to a hybrid software-hardware enforcement paradigm.
Let's unpack this three-layer defense because it's really a masterclass in secure systems design. Defense layer one is dynamic process isolation, or DPRICE.
Yes, DPRICE.
The autopsy describes this as a runtime behavioral telemetry engine. Returning to our open plan office analogy, if the software sandbox was the passive HR policy, DPRICE is the active AI-driven security guard patrolling the floor.
And this guard isn't just checking ID badges. They are analyzing micro behaviors. DPARS continuously profiles the execution patterns of every single worker script in real time. It is looking for the specific behavioral signatures of a side channel attack.
What does that actually look like to the security guard?
It looks like an anomaly in the workflow. The system monitors for excessive microarchitectural branch patterns, essentially noticing if a script is trying to train the branch predictor in a suspicious way. It looks for unusual memory access loops.
And network traffic.
Crucially, in the context of the RTSS exploit, it monitors network telemetry. If it sees a worker opening a persistent WebSocket stream that never closes and is rapidly bouncing tiny packets back and forth with highly specific timing intervals.
The security guard immediately realizes someone is building a remote stopwatch.
Yeah.
So what does the system do when it detects this? It doesn't just block the network connection, does it?
No, it takes much more drastic action to protect the surrounding tenants. The moment DPRICE flags a script as highly anomalous, it triggers a dynamic eviction.
Dynamic eviction.
It instantly rips that specific worker script out of the shared V8, isolate the open plan office, and drops it into a dedicated single-tenant Linux process.
Oh, it throws the suspicious actor into solitary confinement.
Exactly. It completely physically segregates the potential attacker.
Yeah.
Once they are in solitary confinement, they no longer share a CPU cache with anyone else. The cross-tenant side channel is instantly neutralized.
That is so smart.
And because this only happens to scripts exhibiting malicious behavior, the vast majority of legitimate normal traffic never experiences a performance hit.
It's security through active segregation. Okay, defense layer two, deep V8 sandbox integration. The source details how they incorporated Google's hardened V8 sandbox architecture, specifically focusing on how memory is mapped.
Right.
The technical description mentions bounding all JavaScript heap allocations and memory pointers within a contiguous 1 terabyte virtual address space. Explain how this stops the muddy footprints.
This is a highly technical mitigation aimed directly at how speculative execution navigates memory. The core concept is preventing unauthorized pointer arithmetic.
Okay, pointer arithmetic.
In a side channel attack, the attacker often tries to trick the speculative execution engine into calculating an address that points outside of its allowed memory region. They try to trick the librarian into calculating the exact aisle and shelf number of the secret vault.
Right, because if you don't know where the vault is, you can't send the librarian there.
So the hardened V8 sandbox uses a technique called pointer compression and masking. It ensures that every single memory address the worker script attempts to calculate is mathematically forced to remain within a specific, heavily controlled 1 terabyte virtual sandbox.
So it traps them.
Even if the attacker successfully tricks the branch predictor into executing out-of-bounds pointer arithmetic, the mathematical mask ensures that the resulting virtual address simply cannot map to anything outside that safe zone. The speculative operation is essentially trapped in a hall of mirrors. No matter where it tries to go, it always ends up pointing back inside its own safe, isolated sandbox.
That sounds incredibly robust. But Cloudflare didn't stop there. They knew software mitigations can eventually be bypassed, so they implemented the crown jewel of this defense, the feature that definitively moves the needle from software to hardware.
Yeah, this is the big one.
Defense Layer 3, hardware memory protection keys, specifically leveraging Intel MPK. The autopsy refers to this as an x86 CPU feature called Protection Keys for User Space, or PKU. Explain how this works, because this seems to be the ultimate trump card against Spectre.
Intel MPK is indeed the definitive hardware-level enforcement mechanism. To understand why it's so powerful, you have to understand how memory permission traditionally works. Usually, the operating system kernel is responsible for deciding who can access what memory.
The OS acts as the gatekeeper.
Right. If a program tries to access memory it shouldn't, the hardware alerts the operating system. The operating system kernel steps in, checks the permissions, and blocks it.
But that back-and-forth communication between the hardware and the operating system takes a relatively long time, right?
It takes an eternity in CPU time. It requires what's called a kernel context switch, which is incredibly slow. It's far too slow to stop a speculative execution attack, which happens entirely within the hardware in a matter of nanoseconds before the operating system even realizes what's going on.
Right, so the librarian gets in and out of the vault before the security guard at the front desk can even answer the phone.
Precisely. So Intel MPK bypasses the operating system entirely for these checks. What it does is assign hardware-enforced permission tags directly to individual memory pages within the physical silicon. Think of it as fundamentally color-coding the physical memory.
Color-coding, I like that.
The CPU assigns the color red to tenant A and the color blue to tenant B.
And these tags are checked by the hardware itself.
Yes, by the memory management unit, or MMU. This enforcement happens at the lowest possible physical level. So even if the speculative branch execution or overeager librarian is successfully tricked into attempting an out-of-bounds read into a different tenant's memory, the memory management unit sees the operation as it's happening.
It catches them in the act.
It checks the hardware permission tag on the memory page, sees a color mismatch, and physically blocks the read at the silicon level.
It slams the door shut in nanoseconds. It doesn't ask the operating system for permission. The hardware just violently rejects the operation.
Completely rejects it.
And the most mind-blowing part of this entire layered defense is the performance data. Cloudflare achieved rapid global deployment of these hardware-assisted mitigations with zero measurable latency degradation. I want to push back on that, too.
It sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
It really does. How can you add AI behavioral monitoring, complex pointer masking, and constant hardware tag checking and not slow down the 5-millisecond response time?
It seems contradictory, but it comes down to architectural efficiency. The behavioral monitoring DIPRISE runs out of band. It's a separate process analyzing telemetry, so it doesn't block the execution path of the worker itself. The pointer masking in the V8 sandbox is optimized down to a few ultra-fast bitwise operations. But the real magic is the Intel MPK. Because the permission tags are integrated directly into the page table entries, the memory management unit checks them in parallel with standard address translation. It adds virtually zero clock cycles to the operation.
So they managed to perfectly secure the open plan office without having to build the slow, heavy concrete bunkers. They saved the serverless model.
It is a monumental engineering victory. They prove that absolute high performance and robust hardware isolation are not mutually exclusive concepts. You don't necessarily have to choose between extreme speed and extreme security if you are capable of correctly orchestrating the advanced features of modern silicon.
So Cloudflare patched their network, they survived the Arteus Spectre attack. But as you noted, cloud platforms are massive, complex ecosystems. They aren't infallible black boxes. How is the rest of the cloud industry reacting to this 2026 revelation?
The postmortem provides a very revealing comparative matrix of the isolation models across the leading serverless platforms as of late 2026.
And what does it show?
It clearly shows an industry fractured in its approach to this threat.
Well, let's run through them. We talked about AWS Lambda earlier. They stuck with the concrete bunkers, right?
Yes. AWS Lambda relies heavily on hardware micro-VMs, utilizing the KVM hypervisor and their custom Firecracker technology. The benefit here is absolute, complete kernel boundary immunity to Spectre side-channel attacks. You are physically segregated.
But there's a cost.
As we discussed, they still pay that heavy operational tax, 50 to 250 millisecond cold starts, and a massive 128 megabyte base memory overhead. It's highly secure, but it is not optimized for instantaneous edge routing.
What about the newer players trying to balance speed and security? The autopsy mentions Fastly and Dinu Deploy.
Fastly took a different architectural route by relying on WebAssembly, utilizing runtimes like Lucet and WasmTime. WebAssembly is fundamentally designed around a linear memory sandbox, which provides high inherent immunity to these types of speculative execution leaks. They achieve under 10 millisecond cold starts, offering a very compelling balance.
And Adapt.
Dinu Deploy, on the other hand, utilizes V8 isolates combined with a REST runtime. They also hit that sub-10 millisecond latency, but they rely primarily on traditional software sandboxing, which, as this exploit proves, only offers moderate inherent immunity unless heavily augmented.
Given that variation, how is the market reacting? If I'm a chief information security officer at a Fortune 500 company looking at this RTS exploit, what am I demanding from my cloud providers?
The market sentiment has shifted drastically and aggressively. The enterprise security surveys cited in the aftermath of this disclosure reveal a massive pivot. Over 82% of Fortune 500 CISOs are now explicitly mandating hardware-level memory protection as a strict, non-negotiable procurement requirement.
Meaning they won't even sign a contract unless you prove you have hardware defenses.
Correct. They are specifically requiring architectures that integrate Intel MPK, or AMD's equivalent technology, SEV Secure Encrypted Virtualization. The enterprise sector is loudly stating, if you want to handle our sensitive edge compute workloads, you cannot rely solely on software sandboxes anymore. The physics have proven them fundamentally unsafe.
That is a massive tectonic shift in cloud architecture demands. But let's bring this down to the ground level. We've talked about what the massive cloud providers are doing, but what about the developers?
Right, the people writing the code.
Exactly, the developers who are actually deploying applications onto these edge networks. The autopsy provides a four-step enterprise hardening blueprint, and the core premise of this blueprint is fascinating. It tells developers that they must assume the underlying cloud platform is compromised.
It's a harsh reality.
They must assume their memory contents could always be actively probed under adversarial conditions.
That is the essence of defense in depth and zero trust architecture. You cannot treat the cloud provider as an infallible shield. You have to write defensive code.
Let's discuss these four steps, not just as a checklist, but as real-world architectural decisions, because implementing these is going to cause friction.
Definitely.
Step one is aggressive JWT time to live, or PTL, truncation. The blueprint says to restrict edge-verified access tokens to ultra-short expiration windows, ideally under 5 minutes.
The logic here is a direct mathematical countermeasure to the 12 bits per second extraction rate. It takes a specific amount of time for an attacker to siphon a complete token out of the CPU cache.
Right.
If you strictly truncate the lifespan of that token, you ensure that it mathematically expires and becomes completely useless before the attacker can even finish downloading it, let alone weaponize it.
It makes perfect sense mathematically. You can't stop them from copying the key, so you change the lock every 5 minutes.
Exactly.
But from a developer standpoint, isn't that a massive user experience nightmare? If the VIP pass expires every 5 minutes, does the user have to type in their password 12 times an hour? How do you implement this without infuriating your customers?
That's the friction you mentioned. To solve the UX problem, developers have to implement complex background refresh token architectures. The 5-minute JWT is just for immediate access.
Okay, so it happens behind the scenes.
Yeah, in the background, the application uses a separate, cryptographically bound one-time refresh token to silently request a new JWT from the secure origin server every 4 minutes. It drastically increases the architectural complexity of your authentication flow, but it is absolutely necessary to mitigate the slow drip exfiltration threat.
Step 2. Elimination of long-lived in-memory secrets. The blueprint advises developers to stop storing static database connection strings, master cryptographic signing keys, or private API secrets in global worker variables.
This is about reducing your attack surface. If a master signing key sits in the global memory of an edge worker permanently, it is a permanent static target for a side channel probe. The attacker has all day to slowly read it.
So what's the alternative?
The mitigation strategy advises utilizing short-lived asymmetric key pairs or ephemeral HMAC tokens that rotate constantly.
Again, the trade-off here is performance. If the worker doesn't have the master key in its memory, it has to fetch it or negotiate a new key, which adds latency to the process.
Right.
You are trading speed for security at the application layer.
You are. And that leads directly into step 3, end-to-end origin signature verification.
This one fundamentally challenges the entire point of edge computing. The blueprint says that for high-value transactions, you shouldn't rely solely on the edge worker's validation.
Exactly. Let's say a user is authorizing a massive financial wire transfer or altering core security settings on their account. The edge worker might inspect the JWT and say, yes, this token is valid.
Right.
But if you assume the edge worker's memory might be compromised, you can't trust that validation for a critical action.
So you have to double check it.
You require a secondary validation, often utilizing cryptographically secure nonces that is processed entirely by hardened origin servers located in dedicated, highly secure virtual private cloud clusters. You essentially architect your system to say, I trust the edge worker for quick, low-risk routing and serving static content, but for the highly sensitive operations, I demand a second opinion from the secure concrete bunker.
Which, again, introduces latency for those specific actions, but it compartmentalizes the risk. Finally, step 4, WebSocket session auditing and throttling. This one feels like a direct, targeted attack on the RTS mechanism itself.
It is a surgical strike against the attacker's methodology. If the attacker absolutely relies on a persistent WebSocket connection to act as their remote high-resolution stopwatch, you aggressively disrupt their ability to establish or maintain that stopwatch.
The blueprint tells developers to enforce strict rate limiting and connection duration caps on long-lived WebSocket connections, specifically within edge routes that process sensitive authentication payloads. But what if your application legitimately needs a persistent WebSocket?
That's the hard part.
Like, what if you're building a real-time financial trading dashboard or a live collaborative document editor?
That is the ultimate architectural friction. Developers have to carefully segment their traffic. You cannot run your highly sensitive JWT verification logic in the same edge route that maintains an open, unmonitored WebSocket for a chat application. You have to aggressively audit those connections.
So they have to be actively looking for it.
If a WebSocket stays open too long or starts transmitting tiny packets at perfectly even, rapid intervals, the signature of a timing oracle, your application logic must forcefully terminate the connection. You have to actively hunt the stopwatch.
So if we look back at the incredible ground we've covered today, it really paints a picture of an industry at war with its own physical foundations. We started by looking at the architectural compromises of edge computing, how the desperate need to eliminate 300 millisecond cold starts pushed the cloud industry away from the safety of secure micro VMs and into the shared hyper-efficient open plan office of V8 isolates.
We examined how that compromise opened the door to the physics of speculative execution, specifically the Spectre Variant 2 vulnerability, where a tricked branch predictor leaves transient readable footprints in the CPU cache.
And then we unpacked the sheer, terrifying ingenuity of the remote timer as a service attack. The realization that an attacker doesn't need a local clock. They can use the latency and statistical noise of the internet itself as a remote stopwatch.
It's brilliant and terrifying.
Achieving a 12 bit per second exfiltration rate with 99.2% accuracy across a WebSocket stream is nothing short of science fiction made real. We saw how this completely eviscerated the concept of a software sandbox, directly threatening the core mechanisms of enterprise authentication, especially JSON web tokens.
And finally, we explored the formidable hardware-assisted response, Cloudflare's triple-tier defense, utilizing the behavioral telemetry of Deprize, the deep memory masking of the V8 sandbox, and most importantly, the silicon speed enforcement of Intel memory protection keys. They managed to retrofit hardware security into a high-speed environment.
It has been an absolute masterclass in the ongoing escalating arms race between hardware vulnerability discovery and defensive systems engineering.
It certainly has. But as we wrap up this analysis, I want to leave everyone listening with a lingering, forward-looking question.
Ooh, I like a good question to end on.
It's a question based on the continuous cycle of vulnerability and mitigation we've discussed today. We have clearly seen that purely software-based sandboxes fundamentally failed under the weight of speculative execution, forcing the entire industry to retreat to hardware-level enforcement mechanisms like Intel MPK.
Right.
The industry is currently hailing these hardware tags as the ultimate savior of serverless computing. But we must logically ask ourselves, what happens when the next generation of academic research discovers microarchitectural flaw within the memory protection keys themselves? If we decide that hardware is the ultimate final arbiter of trust, who guards the guards at the silicon level?
A deeply chilling thought to end on, but that is exactly why we explore these events. The digital fortress is never truly finished. We just keep inventing more complicated types of glass. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the 2026 serverless edge collapse. Take a moment today to look closely at your own cloud vendor's isolation guarantees and perhaps review how your application handles its most sensitive keys. You might realize your walls are thinner than you think. Until next time.